Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast from the Center for Science and Culture. I'm Robert Crowther at the Center in Seattle, and joining us today we have a professor, a teacher, a biologist, and an author, Scott Turner. He is at the State University of New York, where he teaches in the Environmental Science and Forestry Department. He's a visiting scholar at Cambridge University, and he has a new book from HarperCollins. It's called Purpose and Desire: What Makes Something Alive and Why Modern Darwinism Has Failed to Explain It. And the book has been described as a thoughtful appeal to widen our perspective of biology that is grounded in scientific evidence and helps us bridge the ideological evolutionary divide. And I'm hoping we can talk about that a little bit today. Thanks for being here, Scott.
Rob, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yes. Why don't we start out with, if you could just tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book. I mean, you're obviously not just trying to make friends in the scientific establishment, because you kind of challenged that a little bit with this one.
Well, I came to write the book because, one of the reasons was that my second book, The Tinkerer's Accomplice, was criticized by some of my colleagues for not defining a central concept that I think is very important, called homeostasis. And so I started writing the book for that reason, to try to fill that in. But the book actually developed in some interesting ways. There's some history there. My book, The Tinkerer's Accomplice, its subtitle was How Design Emerges from Life Itself, and there's that dreaded word design in there. And this came out shortly after the Dover trial had been completed. And of course, there was a lot of, I think, public hysteria about what intelligent design was and what it was saying and these kinds of things. And so even though I took some pains, you know, starting with the third sentence of the book to say that I'm really not talking about intelligent design in this book, despite what the title might imply, I'm really trying to deal with the phenomenon of design. Is it real? You know, if you look at the ways organisms are built, the impression of design is very, very strong. And I was arguing in that book that, yes, it's strong because design in life is real. And it's incumbent upon us as biologists to be able to really understand what design is. Now, as a result of the kind of controversy after the Dover trial, people like Steve Meyer started saying, well, you know, why don't you come to some of our conferences? And I thought, all right, well, you know, it'd be good to get to know these guys to see what they're really talking about. And one of the things that impressed me, first of all, was the validity, I think, of the critique of intelligent design theory of modern evolution. Once I finally grappled with it, I thought that the critique was actually quite sound. I didn't quite go along with the conclusions that were drawn from that, but nevertheless, you know, there were some serious arguments being made here. And the other thing that I noticed at these conferences was the audience. You know, the people who would come to these conferences, they weren't necessarily evolutionary biologists or even biologists, but they were typically very thoughtful, very intelligent, very engaged people. A lot of teachers, of high school teachers, for example, lots of engineers, lots of computer scientists, and the debate, I thought, was actually really quite rich. And I thought that, you know, these people are being very ill-served by people like me and evolutionary biology in particular. You know, the kind of smear campaign, for example, against intelligent design theory and against its practitioners who are actually quite capable and quite intelligent and honest people, I thought something needed to be written to kind of broaden the debate, to kind of come in there and bridge what seemed to be a public divide between Darwinian evolution on the one hand and intelligent design people on the other. And as I said, you know, there's a valid critique that comes out of intelligent design theory. And, you know, without dismissing the achievements of Darwinian biology, there has to be some way of bridging that divide. And in public, it just wasn't being done. You know, it was dragging people into courtrooms, kind of almost smear campaigns against people who were actually quite thoughtful scholars. And so Let's delve into this a little bit, and that's what the book ended up being. So it was addressed very much to the public, very much to people who are engaged in the whole public debate over evolution, how we should teach it, how we should think about it, those kinds of things, and to try to bring basically a way of maybe elevating the discussion a little bit beyond what was characteristic of, say, the Dover controversy.
Right. Yeah, it seems that in the public discussion, at least on the sort of neo-Darwinian side, there are the evolutionary cheerleaders like Richard Dawkins and others who have a very, you know, strident view, and it's all or nothing, and it's only that. When you were doing the research and interacting with scientists, did you find that kind of your average everyday scientists working in the lab or out in the field, do they adhere to that, or do they have a more nuanced approach to it? Is the divide as big as some people claim it is?
I don't think it's as big as some people would claim, because when I would talk about this at seminars, for example, I'd be invited to colleagues' universities to discuss this. I would often find that, you know, people's eyes would start darting nervously about when I started speaking about this, but only rarely was I confronted with a hostile response to it. You know, once I could engage in discussion, you know, the acknowledgement would generally be, well, yes, you know, you have a point. Life is intentional. It obviously is. But, you know, the idea is that we can't think about life in that way because it's not a scientific way of thinking about life. And at this point, you have to say, well, you know, what is the proper scientific way to think about life? You know, is it scientifically proper only to think about life as mechanism or as materialism or as a phenomenon of chemistry? And okay, that's a position, but you are ultimately led to the inability to define what life is. And one of the pernicious aspects of the mechanistic philosophy of life is that it's actually alienated the science of life from the phenomenon of life itself. And I think that we need to basically reconnect our scientific way of thinking to this purposeful attribute of life, which is what makes it absolutely distinctive. Now, when you start talking about the kinds of strident views that are out there in the public view, you know, let's face it, we're dealing with a question that is no longer scientific, but now political. And,
right,
you know, then you have to get into, you know, what are the political motivations behind keeping this debate going. And one of the odd things I found about the Dover trial, I actually, you know, spent some time looking into it, you know, is, you know, have we really moved beyond the Scopes trial? You know, the very same arguments were being made in the Dover cases were being made in the Scopes trial. And haven't we moved beyond that? And I would argue that scientifically, yes, we have, but for some reason in the public sphere, we don't talk about that, especially when it comes to how you teach evolution in schools, even to the point of how you teach evolution in universities and proper ways to think about evolution versus improper ways. And you know, you're really talking there about a political, cultural issue there that's, you know, I think could be elevated a bit beyond what it is lately.
Right. Yeah, there is obviously a lot of things on the periphery of the, like you might say, the hard science, the politics and the philosophy and some of these things that are kind of one step removed from, you know, like really hard research in the lab or the field. And it reminds me, I don't know if you're familiar with the late National Academy of Sciences member, Philip mm-hmm. Skill. And he used to do a lot of writing about the distinction between experimental biology and, you know, origin of life research biology, kind of evolutionary yeah. biology. There's a lot yeah. of overlap, but he found that experimental biology is making, you know, huge strides forward, as we can see all the time. And it does that perfectly well without having an evolutionary ideology put on top of it. And he saw it kind of almost as window dressing in some of the articles. The scientists were like No, they didn't necessarily need to have an evolutionary ideology to do the work they were doing, or even making some of the breakthroughs that they did. And I think that's some of that is where the politics and the philosophy come in. And you're saying that the public hasn't caught up yet, but the science is way ahead of that. It's kind of like people don't understand how advanced the biology has become in many ways.
Well, biology is a wonder to behold. You know, there's no taking away the incredible success of molecular biology and the expansion of our knowledge of just how life works. And, you know, the lots of good things that are coming from that. There's simply no doubt about that. But, you know, it works both ways as well. You know, just as molecular biology has kind of divorced itself from any notion that this is a product of an evolutionary process, it's worked the other way as well. You know, if you look at modern evolutionary thought, for example, it's very strongly focused on gene selection. Has been since the 1920s, basically. And this has led to a very, very mechanistic picture of what evolution is and how it works. You know, it's basically trying to box evolutionary thought into the same kind of philosophical framework that molecular biology does. And the pernicious aspect of that is that, you know, just as molecular biologists don't need evolution to think constructively about how, say, an enzyme chain reaction works, it's turned around the other way as well, because evolutionary biology has now got itself into a position where it doesn't need to understand how life works, how it actually works. You know, it's this very abstract picture of gene selection and so forth. And one of the arguments that I've tried to make in the book is that distinction that you're drawing there is on all sides is false. You know, you can understand better how life works if you understand how life has evolved, but it does work the other way as well. You cannot understand how life has evolved if you try to divorce evolution from the way life works. And one of the things that this focus on gene selection has done is that it's driven a wedge right through the middle of biology, you know, and it makes it very difficult to study coherently what is basically a coherent phenomenon. You know, it not only works, but it also evolves. And I argue in the book that really it's time to kind of take that wedge out and approach it all as a coherent phenomenon.
Right, more holistically, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that you do talk about quite a bit in the book is this tendency to think, you know, in mechanistic terms, to talk about living things as machines. We do this all the time. We talk about people as computer, the brain is like a computer, and there's a lot of comparison between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, which is obviously mechanistic. Is all of this approach to biological machines an accurate way to think about living things? Because there is obviously some aspect to it, but is that limiting in any way?
I think it's one way to think about brains. Let's talk about those for a bit. The metaphor of the brain as a machine comes from a longstanding trend, you know, since the 1940s, basically, of trying to build machines to behave like living things. And of course, one of the early proponents of this was Norbert Wiener, who was the father of cybernetics and robotics and those kinds of disciplines. And out of that has come the metaphor of the brain as computer. And this is, of course, driving all of artificial intelligence. It's driving a lot of the way we tend to think about the brain as a computer, primarily as a computer. But if you delve into the way brains actually work, the way brains actually work, it's very hard to pick out a computer from that. It's without doubt that brains do compute, but is that really what brains do? You know, or is this an epiphenomenon that lies over something deeper that's going on? And if you look at the way that the brain actually works, you know, the brain as computer metaphor really starts to break down. You know, for example, there's a great deal of redundancy between different systems that couldn't be explained as the development of an efficient computing machine. It's very hard to see how brain cells or collections of brain cells actually act as computers. And when you start actually really delving into the brain, it's like this roiling ecosystem of chemical warfare going on in there between different populations of nerve cells. And somehow out of that comes a coherently functioning brain that can make coherent cognitive images of the world and can process them and these kinds of things. And when you start talking about the differences between computers and brains, you start getting into a situation where it's hard to explain the way that the brain works without also bringing in a concept of agency. That is, the brain puts out computations because in a deep sense it actually wants to compute in a way that a computer cannot. You know, it's very hard to attribute wanting and desire to a computer, but it's actually very easy to attribute it to ourselves. And so, you know, you're really talking about competing metaphors for how we approach the brain. You know, some of them have been very successful in some respects, but have failed in others. And it's true for almost any kind of metaphor that you try to bring to how the brain works. And the argument that I make in the book is, of course, when you're talking about living things, it's impossible to get away from this fundamental intentionality, this fundamental striving and wanting to get to some purposeful end that you simply just can't find in machines.
And that's the purpose and desire from the title, which seems, in your view, to permeate everything right down to the smallest micro level of our cells and things.
That's right. You know, it's a universal cognition. It applies not only to organisms with complex brains like ourselves, but right down to the smallest and simplest microbe that there is. You know, these living things, they are very unstable and precariously perched phenomena. And because of that, they are continually breaking down. And in order to persist, they have to be continually built up again. Work has to be done. And that cannot happen without an awareness of the environment, without some ability to map that environment onto some physiological function, and then work to be done to modify the environment to keep that precarious orderliness persistent through time. And so, yes, it's I argue, a universal phenomenon of life.
Yes. Well, I want to close out this interview by asking if there's anything particularly striking that you've learned from putting this book out there. Have the reactions surprised you, or is it kind of what you expected? Have you know, been surprised or learned anything new from sort of the debates that Purpose and Desire has ignited?
One of the things that has been brought home quite strongly to me is the importance of a worldview in shaping our thinking. You know, a big part of the book is a historical review of how modern evolutionary biology got to where it is. And so I do delve into some of the history of this and some of the thought of this. And two things come from this. One is that there are a lot of brilliant minds that have been applied to trying to figure out just how evolution works. But they've been limited by a particular worldview, namely that, you know, life has to be a mechanism. We can't think about it in any other way. We can't introduce purposefulness into our thinking about life, because that would somehow distort our scientific way of approaching life. And so, you know, you had absolutely brilliant minds working on this, but they were constrained by kind of self-imposed metaphorical boxes, if you will. And one of the consequences of that is that if you look at how evolution has really developed compared to how the public is often told how evolution has developed, the real story is just incredibly rich, and it's a story that really deserves to be told, and it's a story that I think would inform our public debate about evolution. I think quite a bit, and I hope it can do that. Now, coming to the reactions that the book has had, I've had some that have been quite predictable. So, for example, some of the people who make a living out of critiquing anything that strays from the Darwinian reservation, if you will, you know, some of those have been quite predictable, but you know, quite uninformed. There was one person in particular who had very pointed and critical things to say about the book and about me personally, who actually had not read the book. And you can see this in some of the reviews out there now. And so that's the predictable part. But I've been quite gratified, actually, by the reception that the book has had amongst some of my scientific colleagues. We've just had a review come out in quarterly review of biology, for example, by an Israeli chemist, Adi Pras, who, you know, who's an absolutely mainstream, good scientist. He's done a lot of pioneering work on origin of life, and he quite liked it. And I've had similar reactions, not so much in reviews published publicly yet, but I've had a good reception from a number of my thoughtful colleagues, and that's been very, very gratifying to see. Now the task is to get it out there, more broadly read in the public. And so I really appreciate being able to come on to this podcast to talk with you about this.
Well, I appreciate your being here. I think your book is really fantastic. You're quite brave to tackle some of this, I think. And it's really compelling, and it opens up a lot of new dialogue, which is super important in the overall debate, and just in helping have healthy science so that we can have these debates without people going down the predictable path of yelling and arm waving and so on. It's better to engage and really get involved in these ideas. And I would hope that our listeners will engage with this book. It is called Purpose and Desire: What Makes Something Alive and Why Modern Darwinism Has Failed to Explain It. I'm sure you can get it at most bookstores. We will have a link to it to Amazon for the book on our page at ID the Future. It's definitely provocative and a bit controversial and a good read. I think people will enjoy it. I'd like to thank you for being here, Scott, and we should do it again. We'll try and touch base one more time about some of these things, and then I'm sure you've got another book in you, and we'll be talking about that someday.
That'd be great, Rob. Thanks again for having me on and this conversation.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.